Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Off houses, you'd find swine.
I don't want you to touch my mother. So go away, I'm warning you. Go away or I'll kill you myself. Your hands! Let me go, Uncle Charlie! Let me go!
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
You know, I need to find one of those lonely widow dating services, Mike. Do you know of any?
I've got a song. It's on the tip of my tongue. I might be able to help you out. This week, we're looking at Alfred Hitchcock's 1943 film, Shadow of a Doubt. The film stars Teresa Wright as young Charlie, a teen in Santa Rosa, California, who shares the name of her uncle, Charles Oakley, played by Joseph Cotten. When we first see the two of them, Uncle Charlie lies on his bed in a boarding house while two unnamed men wait for him on the street below. Meanwhile, young Charlie lies on her bed in Santa Rosa, bemoaning to her father how boring their lives have become. With the imminent arrival of Uncle Charlie, things are about to get a lot more interesting. So, Rob, what did you think of Shadow of a Doubt, sir?
Well, I remember seeing this actually in a film class. I think I was maybe even in high school at the time when I first saw it in film class, and I really liked it then. I have to say it's probably one of the best performances from Joseph Cotten. I mean, this is coming on the heels of Kane just 2 years before, and this is a good 6 or 7 years before he steps up to the plate and takes over with The Third Man. And it's right in that classic period for him where he's doing just some great stuff. The thing I find interesting about the film is that it seems to me like this movie would be newer. You know what I mean? It almost seems like this would be post-World War II because there is kind of a cynicism in it. But it's kind of amazing that it was actually made during the World War II era and has that kind of cynicism.
I don't know if, I'm not one to run around saying this is a film noir or this isn't, but there is that real undertone going on to this as far as, this kind of a really harsh look at America and the American family and what kind of bad things can be going on in small town life. I mean, the whole thing, Santa Rosa is kind of painted as this idyllic place where Charlie and her family are and how great it is, but yet you've got the mom who is kind of, working her fingers to the bone. You've got dad whose hobby is talking about planning murders with the next door neighbor. You've got Roger, the younger son, who's this absolutely insane OCD kid who should maybe have some Ritalin or something going on with him. And then Anne, the younger sister, who's just obsessed with books, who can't even like take her eyes off of her own books while she's trying to take a phone call. And then you've got Charlie at the center of it, who kind of can see that this idyllic existence maybe isn't all that it's cracked up to be, but she can't quite put her finger on what's wrong. And she thinks having Uncle Charlie there is what's going to make a huge difference.
It's a film that's interesting. I mean, let's just talk about the family and the way it's lined up. I like that the dad and the neighbor who are into crime fiction are just obsessive on crime fiction. I love the little girl, Anne, who is just a bookworm, reading all the time, and she's just like a smarty pants. And I root for her the most. I actually wish that she had more screen time. And the thing that really works in this also that brings out a sense of realism with this, that unlike a lot of – and it's not to say that the acting is 100% real, because, of course, this is still the 1940s, and you're dealing with a little bit of a stilted performance at times. But one of the things that's really interesting in terms of what Hitchcock does with the staging is the overlapping dialogue. And you really hear that in the interactions between the kids and the mother. You hear it quite a bit in that section and then in other parts of the film. And to me, that was fascinating to see, because before that, it was like, okay, you deliver your line, you deliver your line. And everyone thinks that like overlapping dialogue was something that, I don't know, came in with Robert Altman or something. But it looks like Hitchcock was starting to experiment with that idea and sort of how it can make it really real within the context of a picture, especially if you're dealing with a crime film.
When it comes to overlapping dialogue, Hitchcock was definitely there, but I think like a Howard Hawks is kind of the master of it when it comes to things like the front page or 20th century, just with this rapid fire delivery as they're going back and forth and speaking at the same time. It's just insane.
For His Girl Friday, I always remember as well.
Yeah, there's so many nice like little asides and stuff even. I was listening to the film, pulling out some of the audio clips and stuff, and just hearing some of the things when you're not watching it, you can hear like, you know, the mom saying stuff like when her first appearance, she's talking about how steep the back steps are, and it's like, yeah, okay, nice foreshadowing. And just this screenplay is just so rich. It's crazy just how many levels and layers you've got going on through this, and just the way that it goes. And, you know, before we started recording tonight, you know, you had said that this is a suspense film, but it's not really a mystery film. There's not really a whole lot of whodunit, because we get that right out of the gate.
Yeah, I mean, we basically know from Go that it's Joseph Cotten. The question really becomes, is he going to be found out? How is he going to be found out? And what's going to happen in the end? And how is his presence within the room going to change this family or this community that he's now appeared in? So I think that we're watching it more from the aspect of the outsider who comes in, who is, I guess, maybe the wolf in sheep's clothes kind of idea. I mean, maybe if you wanted to read a level into this, and if it was 10 years later, it obviously would have been more pronounced in that way, that it could be almost like a comment on the Red Scare or something, where it's like, ooh, there's a traitor in our midst kind of thing. You know, he looks like us, but don't be fooled, folks. He's a bad guy. So it's interesting how that's staged.
We pretty much know that he's guilty, you know, from the get-go. There's a little bit of a doubt when, you know, knowing you're watching an Alfred Hitchcock film, and Hitchcock is kind of famous for like these wrong man plots, you know, where you've got, you know, especially like North by Northwest, you know, with Roger Thornhill being mistaken for another character before an agent that doesn't exist, and he's, you know, being pursued, and you've got that. So you're coming into this retroactively, I suppose, with the idea of Hitchcock setting up people to be pursued when they aren't guilty. You know, the wrong man obviously is one of those. And we have a little bit of Joseph Cotten trying to elude these figures who we're not sure who they are. I mean, you could be watching this and thinking of, you know, him as the Swede in Hemingway's The Killers or something. But pretty quickly, we find out that he's not all that he's cracked up to be. And I think one of the first instances that we get of that is the way that he comes into town. And I've always found this to be really strange, the way that he comes in on this train. And when he does, there's this black cloud that kind of comes over everything. And Uncle Charlie has been reportedly sick, because we don't necessarily even see him on the train. We hear people talking about him, and that's when we get the Hitchcock cameo, when we've got these people playing cards and they're talking about this poor sick man who, you know, isn't able to come out or anything. And when he does come out of the train, he's acting all like hobbled and sickly and all this kind of stuff. And then finally, when he gets to the ground, he kind of regains his energy, and it kind of, he's almost like a psychic vampire. He takes all of the energy from the kids and from his family, and that kind of, you know, bolsters him. But already we know he's kind of not everything that he's cracked up to be. And then shortly thereafter, we get him giving a ring, and it's got someone else's initials on it.
With the character names as well, as we alluded to, you alluded to in the front end, is the concept of two Charlies. And I think that really helps in some ways, as you were saying, to build this, you know, well, maybe I got him wrong. Maybe he's not the killer kind of thing, because we're seeing him filtered through the younger Charlie, the female Charlie, the girl. And it is her not wanting to believe that the man who she's been, you know, named after would be able to do such a thing. And like I said, this goes back to the whole idea of family sort of being this. It's almost like you were talking about him coming off the train and sort of, oh, hey, now I can walk. It's like going to Lourdes or something. He's, you know, you can throw away the crutches and a miracle has happened by coming into the family. It's kind of interesting that way.
Small town life, you know, he definitely thrives in that environment. You know, he's got the widows there to poach off of again, and he's got, you know, everyone clamoring to talk about Uncle Charlie. You know, everyone knows him from the cop on the beat who stops young Charlie from trying to run across the street. And Charlie's friends, Catherine, and all these other people, they all know who Uncle Charlie is. And he definitely makes a big splash in this little town. You know, generally, when we talk about movies, we, you know, you and I will pull them apart, but we don't generally tend to do like the full bore film theory analysis kind of thing, except maybe like Bloodsucking Freaks. You know, definitely we did it with that one. With this film, it really just kind of, for me anyway, kind of cries out to be just pulled apart, because there are so many different levels and themes and everything going on in here. When it came to preparing for this episode, I can't even remember when I started preparing for this one, but I went through and found as many articles as I possibly could, just kind of scoured the archives, but found a bunch of books on Hitchcock, a lot of them that I owned already and a bunch that I had to order, and just kind of made this like, I don't know, did you have course packs when you were in college, or had they kind of done away with those by that time?
Yeah, we still had them. I'm old enough.
And did you have to pay through the nose for them?
It could have been. I mean, I remember, I think, paying maybe $50 or something.
Wow. Okay. I think I was right on that cusp when it came to course packs, because when I was buying them the first couple of years in school, it was still like you're paying for the photocopying. It was before the big hullabaloo about paying for the rights of the articles. And I can completely see where these authors were kind of coming from, that they weren't being paid, but yet their stuff was being taught and basically bootlegged, pirated by professors at school. I mean, you would get this course pack and it could be 150 pages or more of however many articles that just the professor thought was interesting and kind of wanted to teach to, and pay $12 for it. You go over to Kinko's or wherever on campus and you say, yeah, I'm looking for the course pack for, you know, Residential 232. They hand you this big freaking thing. You know, okay, you know, $6, please. Thank you. So I pretty much did the same thing, but kind of in PDF form, and then just pored over that for, gosh, probably a few months, and read all of these different interpretations on it. And that's what I think that I like about this film so much, is that you can take it in so many different ways.
To get into it, one of the ones that I read, and it was actually in a book that you gave me, was the Hitchcock, Films of Hitchcock Reconsidered, I believe it was.
Oh, the Robin Wood, I think?
Yeah, and in there, in the section where they talk about Shadow of a Doubt, there's this whole thing about Freudian sexual analysis in terms of who they all represent and sort of, you know, Uncle Charlie being this character who's trying to get it on with not only the young Charlie, but even his own sister, and this sort of sexual ambiguity and sexual tension and all this. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, I actually felt that that was more apparent actually in some of the remakes and other various versions that you had me watch. Not necessarily in this one. It's a little probably more of a subtextual thing than the other ones, where I actually thought it was more pronounced.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about Hitchcock that I like, is that these things are in there and they're subtle and you can pick up on them if you want to. I mean, you can enjoy this film as a suspense film from 1943 about a guy who comes to town who is basically a serial killer, and how is it going to end? And you can just watch it that way, or you can, yeah, start pulling it apart and seeing these things. And I know some people actually really chafe under the idea of film theory, which I just don't understand. I mean, sometimes, yeah, it's like, I just want to enjoy the movie. Don't force this kind of interpretation on me, you know, and it, I guess that's the thing. I guess it's kind of like even with religion, it's like, you can go ahead, you can do your thing, but don't force your viewpoint on me. But if I'm interested in something, I will read about it, and I'll read many other viewpoints as well, because, hey, why not? You know, I'll read an interpretation of Eyes Wide Shut that says one thing, and I'll read another interpretation that says something completely different. But I like to live in a world where I can read all of these different interpretations and enjoy them and, you know, see the movie in a different light.
You know, speaking of, you brought up Bloodsucking Freaks and how I did this analysis of it. And I remember when we did that episode, and if anyone wants to go to projection-booth.com and look at that episode, someone called us out on that, saying that, look, all I wanted to do was know about this film, and it's just supposed to be a roughy good time with, you know, horror and sex and all this stuff, and therefore it should be, you know, I don't understand where all this, like, socialist, you know, feminist, you know, film theory comes from. And I'm like, hey, I'm like, you know, I think my response was, well, that's just what I see in there if you want to consider all the various things that were going on in the culture at the time. So, you know, you may not want to look for it and you just want to enjoy it on the surface level. That's your prerogative. But I just thought that there was something else going on there, and especially wanted to talk about it considering it's a film that most people, and even the guy who distributes it, who we're going to talk to next week, Lloyd Kaufman, thinks that if it came up today, he wouldn't even want to touch it. So I just think that's interesting.
Before you joined on, we had done an episode on The Killer. And I remember, you know, one of the interpretations of John Woo's The Killer is looking at, well, this film and then a lot of other heroic bloodshed films, and seeing that maybe the relationships between the men have more of a homoerotic tone, that you can read these films as kind of a love story from killer to cop, or, you know, two men working together, the underworld, whatever. And just, oh my God, you would have thought that I had raped my former co-host's mother by bringing this thing up.
Well, that's the whole concept of, you know, two men who can't f- will therefore fight each other and kill each other. So it's, you know, just as George Carlin says, you know, change the word kill to the word f- and all those westerns, and there's your new reinterpretation.
I guess let's dive into this a little bit more as far as some of the interpretations. As I read through a lot of these, I did kind of come across, I would say, maybe a handful of really kind of common readings for this film. The phallic reading was definitely one of them, the incest theme. A lot of the articles that I read kind of really looked at the way that that ring is, and this kind of almost evil marriage that we're seeing here between Uncle Charlie and young Charlie, just that kind of creepy incestuous theme. And then also, yeah, I think I don't remember if it was Wood or somebody else, but them talking about the way that he has to address his sister by her maiden name and just keeps kind of casting back to how beautiful she is and the way that she was when they were growing up. And also talking about the whole phallic symbolism, the way that Uncle Charlie is always either carrying a cane or smoking a cigar, and the way that he's kind of grooming Roger to kind of take over for him, especially with sending Roger to the kitchen to bring back this large phallic wine bottle for him. So there's definitely something with that.
Well, I just want to say, you know, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. That's what Freud used to say. So
indeed, indeed. One of the other ones, you know, we talked a little bit about duality, and I think duality is going to be the easiest one for people to pick up on. Just the number of reoccurring themes, things that we're seeing twice, you know, Charlie talking to the police officer twice, Charlie talking to some of her friends two times, the Till 2 bar that they go into. Of course, we've got the two Charlies, but then, you know, even to the point where she's got, you know, two buttons on her coat and all of these different twos that come up. And I mean, I've seen a catalog of, actually, I think I've seen three different authors go through and catalog all of the twos that are in these movies, even to the point where when they go into the Till 2 bar, we've got the waitress saying that she's been there just 2 weeks, and just all of these twos that we're constantly seeing.
The thing, too, with the number two, obviously plays into this whole idea of couples plays into the whole idea of, you know, them being two people with similar names. I mean, you often see it the other way, where it's not two, but three. Like in a lot of films, there'll be three. And then you can go, oh, well, that's, you know, the Holy Trinity, that's triangle, that's all these three-angle things, you know. It's like, so in this, he's definitely going for a binary. He's trying to, I think, give us an idea of it's either good or bad. It's either right or wrong.
And I think as Charlie moves through the film, young Charlie goes through the film, she kind of moves from one side to the other. I mean, being this very virtuous young lady to the point where she threatens Uncle Charlie that she's going to kill him. If he doesn't leave town, if you don't leave town, I'll kill you myself. And then eventually kind of happens. So she kind of takes Uncle Charlie's place in a way.
And you can see that in terms of the idea of maybe them being, you know, sort of that, once again, getting into that duality, the idea of the two sides of people, in that there's the public persona and then there's the hidden. And the idea that you can slip between these good and evil concepts, especially as you were talking about, it's like, okay, you know, hey, I'm the good girl and now I'm going to kill you. And hey, I'm the good uncle and actually I kill people. And hey, I'm the nice, you know, easygoing guy, but everybody sucks. And if you rip the front of the houses off, all you'll see are swine. Just the idea that someone who's, you know, the good, upstanding citizen is also just this, you know, scoundrel.
Definitely another kind of dichotomy that we have going on in here is the idea of sleeping and waking. As we watch the film, we see, well, it opens with both Charlies in bed. And as we go along, sleep really kind of takes this more meaning to it, especially after Charlie finds out that her uncle is evil. She sleeps all day that next day and doesn't come out until dinner, basically. And then we've got the speech that you were just talking about, where rip the fronts off of houses and you'll find swine. And more of that speech is Uncle Charlie talking about, you know, you were living in a dream and I brought you nightmares.
You think you know something, don't you? You think you're the clever little girl who knows something. There's so much you don't know. So much. What do you know, really? You're just an ordinary little girl living in an ordinary little town. You wake up every morning of your life and you know perfectly well that there's nothing in the world to trouble you. You go through your ordinary little day, and at night you sleep your untroubled, ordinary little sleep filled with peaceful, stupid dreams. And I brought you nightmares. Or did I? Or was it a silly, inexpert little lie? You live in a dream. You're a sleepwalker, blind. How do you know what the world is like? Do you know the world is a foul sty? Do you know if you rip the fronts off houses, you'd find swine? The world's a hell. What does it matter what happens in it? Wake up, Charlie. Use your wits. Learn something.
You going, Charlie?
Again, we're talking in this kind of dream, nighttime sleeping imagery. And I think that kind of plays into another theme that people have seen. There have been a couple really good essays written about this, as far as this kind of theme of vampirism through the film. You know, we've got Uncle Charlie coming to town on the train, being sick, not being seen, kind of really reminds me of Nosferatu when he's coming to town. Of course, he's coming on a boat, but, you know, just kind of hidden in the, you know, in the hold, the coffin and everything, and just the way that he shows up in town, and we've got the black cloud that I mentioned before and all this kind of stuff. And we've even got lines like, you know, the cop asking Anne, you know, tell me the story of Dracula, and one of young Charlie's friends saying, you know, how's your throat? And just this kind of idea that Uncle Charlie is kind of coming in, and again, maybe his evil is infecting her. You know, she's sleeping through the day, much like vampires do. And just this whole turning point, too, when she has been in the garage and near death, and it's like she's laying on the ground almost, you might as well either consider her sleeping or dead, and her eyes pop open, and it's like, get away from here, you know, commanding Uncle Charlie. It's like she has become one of him almost at this point. So we've got a lot of vampiric themes too, which I know we'll talk about a lot later, because there was a movie that at least a lot of people think that was kind of based off of Shadow of a Doubt, that is called The Return of Dracula.
That whole scene where she tells him to go or she'll kill him, it would be that change, you know, that vampiric change or whatever, where sort of is the full realization of it. But by the time you get to the end, I would say that she's swung back to her good old self in some way.
I'm not sure, though, because we've got her outside of the church at the end, where we've got Uncle Charlie being eulogized inside. And, you know, that's definitely one place where you're not going to find vampires is standing inside of a church.
My take on the ending, the one thing that I really got out of the ending is especially that whole eulogy at the church and all that stuff. And this, I think, is probably the most damning aspect of the film for me and Hitchcock's indictment of small town American values is, to me, in the end, it's like, oh, he was such a model citizen and such a great man and all this. It's like, even in death, we can't tell the truth, can we? The guy was bad, and it was an evil person. And it's like, in the end, we got to sit here and pretend and play nice and say nice things about the dead when, you know, the people that really know what happened kind of holding their nose and going along with it. It's, to me, the most condemning aspect of this in terms of sort of suburban American values and the idea. And you can even take this, I would say, even to things like Blue Velvet, in that even in suburbia and everything looks picture perfect and beautiful, but there's something going on underneath that just isn't right, and it's been shellacked over and they put a nice veneer on it and make it look all nice, but there's something rotten in Denmark, folks.
Yeah, it's interesting too that Charlie's standing outside of the church with the detective, and the relationship between those two, I think, is really kind of forced in this film. I mean, when he admits that he loves her, I mean, it's just really kind of clunky, and he's only really, I wouldn't even say that it's a date that they've been on, but they've been out once, and all of a sudden it goes from that to being engaged. And, you know, standing near the church, you know pretty soon that they'll be inside and they'll be getting married. One of the other most interesting interpretations of this film for me is this kind of putting Charlie on the right path kind of idea, this kind of patriarchal idea of let's correct Charlie, let's have her basically made marriage ready. You know, she's too nosy. She's gets in trouble because of her investigation. You know, she almost dies because of her investigation a few times. I think three times in this film, you know, I guess breaking the duality thing. Twice at the house. Let's say the house tries to kill her twice and once on the train. So, you know, Hitchcock and trains, they go together like peas and carrots. But just that whole idea of like this kind of fake wedding, the ring that she's being put on her finger, and this whole idea of women losing their identity when they get married. I mean, we've got the ring, the inscription on the ring is, you know, from BM to TS, which is, you could almost flip and say the woman was TS, those were her initials, and then she becomes BM later on, because at that point, women, a lot of times they're not known by their own names. It would be, you know, Mrs. Bruce McDonald is what she would be. And then you've got that really telling speech by the mother where she even says, you know, once you get married, you lose yourself.
But I can't bear it if you go, Charles. Just the idea that we were together again. I'm sorry. But you see, we were so close growing up. And then Charles went away and I got married. And then you know how it is. Your husband's wife sort of forgets who you.
We were pretty lucky when it came to who we were going to talk to about this film. I was really stoked. I got in touch with Tanya Modleski, who I had read a bunch of her stuff. I'm not sure if it was in a course pack or if I actually had bought her book when I was at school, but she had written the book, The Women Who Knew Too Much. And I had read this, I think, if it wasn't in the Hitchcock class I took, it was in one of the feminist, I took several, one of the feminist film criticism classes that I took. And feminist film criticism is just, it's a great branch of film criticism to me, because sometimes the writers will take something that I've never seen before and really kind of explode it and put something new in my face that I've never even considered before, because there's a lot of Lacan and there's a ton of Freud. I mean, the whole theory of feminist film criticism is really steeped in Freud, which is weird to me because to me, Freud's a little bit of a misogynist. So maybe it's kind of this repurposing of the enemy in order to your own purposes. But yeah, so we talked to Tanya Modlesky about her career a little bit and also about her interpretations of Shadow of a Doubt. Just kind of had a nice conversation, two film fans going back and forth, which it was pretty fun. So let's go ahead. We're going to take a break, play back some words from our sponsors, and then interview with Tanya Modlesky.
The Screen Directors Playhouse presentation of Shadow of a Doubt will continue after a short pause for patient identification.
Here are just a few of the things famous people say about the Aftermovie Diner podcast.
Hello, I'm Dame Judi Dench, and when I'm not dusting the submarine, I'm listening to the Aftermovie Diner podcast, you know, for the film reviews.
Hello, I'm Eric Stoltz, and when I'm not taking Uncle to the pictures, I'm listening to the Aftermovie Diner podcast for the interviews.
Hello, I'm Lewis Gossett Jr., and when I'm not trampolining for peace, I'm listening to the Aftermovie Diner podcast for the music.
Hello, Bernie Taupin here, and when I'm not undermining Venezuela, I'm listening to the Aftermovie Diner podcast for the guests.
Hello, I'm Celia Imrie Stunt Double, and when I'm not wanking for tumours, I'm listening to the Aftermovie Diner podcast for the comedy.
Hi there, I'm Ali Sheedy, and when I'm not taking photographs of bricks, I'm listening to the Aftermovie Diner podcast, mostly for the pancakes.
Yes, that's right. The award-winning Aftermovie Diner podcast is all things to all people. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, TalkShoe, Podbean, Facebook, Twitter, and at www.aftermoviediner.com.
Everybody's tweeting, faving, and deleting. Follow Friday, some of you know, and play Dream Tweet. The game show to go. It's the game show to go. Dream Tweet, everybody. It's the celebrity-based Twitter-themed game show that's coming your way, where two Twitter titans go head-to-head in a battle of wits and wisdom. Tune in, subscribe on iTunes, and there'll be a new game every single week. And remember, if things get a little bit sassy, just try and keep in mind that I'm just being a bitch. That's my catchphrase, and I'll be using it, and we'll be having laughs, and it's going to be a lot of fun. It's Dream Tweet, the game show to go, and it's coming soon.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
So I was curious about your early days and when you actually started writing about film and what got you into that.
I was in a program called Modern Thought and Literature at Stanford University, and they had no film courses whatsoever. And I was just back there recently, and they still don't have much. They were very elite in their interests. In the program, we were just a few students, and we got together and taught ourselves, basically, and had these various ad hoc seminars, which they, for some reason, allowed us to put together for ourselves. And it was mostly literature that we were studying. You know, we were supposed to combine. It was other things, whatever we wanted. And but I didn't have literature professors to work with. But a graduate student of mine who was really interested in film introduced me to the foundational feminist theory text, Laura Mulvey's Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema. And I was so interested in that, that I got very excited about just that area of study altogether. And my first actual work in film occurred after I had done a study of Harlequin romances, and that got published, and so I was asked to be on a film panel, and I said, well, I don't know what I could possibly do, and somebody asked me if, and this person asked me if I could talk about soap operas, and I said, oh, yeah, that would be fun. So I started watching soap operas, and integrated a lot of film theory in that, and that was very exciting, and both those pieces turned out to be parts of my dissertation. The third chapter of the dissertation had to do with Gothic novels, and that sent me to Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca and Alfred Hitchcock's adaptation of the novel Rebecca, and so I gave a talk on that for my first job at the interview for my first job and got the job and eventually went on to write a book on Hitchcock.
What was the field of feminist film criticism like when you first started out? I mean, you had mentioned Mulvey, and it seems like kind of everything kind of starts from that point and goes forward.
Yeah, but she wasn't the only one. You know, that piece just struck everybody. You know, it really laid things out so starkly. There were other women, especially in Britain, Claire Johnston and Pam Cook, who were writing really interesting pieces, also using, you know, at that time, French theory was very big, Derrida, Jacques Lacan, and they were incorporating French theory into the study of cinema. And one of them, I forget who now, I think it was Claire Johnston, but it might have been the two of them together, wrote a piece called Women's Cinema as Counter Cinema, which was extremely influential at the time. I remember that Claire Johnston, I think it was in that piece, wound up saying that Laura Mulvey, let me start by saying that Laura Mulvey had said that narrative cinema, Hollywood cinema, basically was irredeemable from a feminist point of view, that it was all oriented towards the male gaze, towards masculine viewership, and so on. But Pam Cook said that the entertainment film, it provides pleasure for women, and we can't just ignore that pleasure, but that feminists should, you know, be attuned to what it is that gives women pleasure and to work from that starting point. And so that, of course, jived very well with my own interest in women's popular culture. So that was extremely influential, too. You know, Laura Mulvey gets most of the credit these days for feminist theory laying the groundwork, but there were other women, too, who did a lot. It was...
Now, you'd mentioned Lacan, and I know that he's been very influential on stuff. What is it about Freud, do you think, that kind of people keep going back to when it comes to interpreting films through a Freudian analysis?
Well, if, you know, to oversimplify, because how could you not? The thing about Freud is that he came up with the idea of the unconscious. And when you're talking about pleasure, you know, you're talking about something that's very deep-rooted and that may appeal to you in ways that you're not even aware of. And to give you an example, I got interested in writing about women's popular culture, especially women's romances, because I had long been addicted to them. Ever since I was like a kid, then I became a feminist and, you know, very militant at the time. And yet I could pick up one of those romances and still find it extremely compelling. So the question for me was, you know, why is it that I find things intellectually even reprehensible, and yet at the same time feel the sort of sway that the fantasies embody, feel the sway that they still hold over me? That was kind of my starting point, and it probably remains an important issue for me. So other analysts kind of sort of skirt the notion of the unconscious and things that we repress and so on. And you know, the feminists who drew on psychoanalysis Francis kept insisting on the importance of the unconscious, which is something that I deeply believe in and I'm always trying to get my students to believe in, usually against their will.
I like that it's kind of a common language almost for this branch of criticism, and it's nice that everyone is kind of reading different variations from the same playbook almost.
Yeah, or at least we were.
You said that your first Hitchcock that you kind of took apart was Rebecca.
Yes.
And I love your interpretation of Rebecca. Can you kind of let folks know, just I hate to do this to you, but a little thumbnail sketch of some of the things that you were picking up in that film that hadn't been examined before?
Rebecca is a story of a classic Gothic story of a woman who falls in love with an older man who's kind of brooding and enigmatic. And in the case of Rebecca, she thinks he's in love with his first wife, whose name is Rebecca, interestingly enough. And Rebecca is dead. And Joan Fontaine plays the unnamed heroine who falls in love with Maxim, who's played by Sir Laurence Olivier, and she comes to live at his huge mansion and to feel tremendously inadequate and to believe that Rebecca's spirit still haunts the place and haunts her husband and that he's still in love with her, even though she's dead, and that that she's nothing compared to Rebecca. The idea of a woman like Rebecca haunting this sort of more traditional love story was really interesting to me. In any case, it turns out, of course, that the husband, in fact, did not love her, but hated her because she was unfaithful to him and possibly a lesbian. And so in the book, he kills her. In the movie, it's a little vaguer because the production code meant that there was no way he could kill her and still be the hero of the story. So she has an accident, kind of, but it's after he strikes her. And so it's a little bit ambiguous as to, you know, who is really at fault here. But then there's an investigation and his name is cleared. And so it's a supposedly happy ending. But I wanted to sort of put an emphasis on the subversive part, which was the strength of this dead woman who have the power to come back and kind of haunt the living and overshadow the love story and undermine the love story in a way. So, and my whole interest in Hitchcock has always been in sort of emphasizing these women that Hitchcock had a fascination for, but also a kind of dread of. And I think that Rebecca is really crucial to a number of his later films, and that the Gothic spirit kind of infuses many of his films.
When it comes to Hitchcock, you know, you ended up writing at least, you know, a half dozen essays on him that later were put together in The Women Who Knew Too Much. What was the next one that you chose to write about, and what kind of brought you to which films of his that you decided to write about over the years?
I decided to write a book about Hitchcock, you know, once I did the Rebecca piece, because, you know, feminists were so interested in Hitchcock because he's, like, such a good filmmaker, and because women are so central to so many of his films. And, you know, there's this question of his misogyny because they're, you know, often treated rather brutally within the film, and there's all this talk about how Hitchcock was really mean to some of his leading ladies and all this stuff. And, you know, I was interested in looking at how, you know, why it is that his novels, which his films, which are in some ways certainly misogynistic, were nevertheless so appealing to women. So I kind of decided to take just two films from each decade. I don't know if it worked out exactly that way, but like two silent films and then two of the earlier black and whites and then three others from his later work, with Psycho kind of infusing the whole thing. And I just picked ones where I thought that the female role was very central and very interesting. And I started with Blackmail, which was filmed as a silent film, and then some of it was remade with talk, and it became a kind of awkward hybrid because he had the woman who was playing the main role had heavy German accent, I believe, and so they had to put a woman behind a screen while she talked her lines, and so there was this kind of sense that she was unable to voice her experience, to talk about her experience, and that came at a time when we were all saying, well, language is all patriarchal, and there is no female language, and so on, so I just thought the idea of talking about this film where women's silence is so central would be an interesting way to start engaging with, you know, with Hitchcock and whether it's true that the woman's voice does in some ways get through despite the silencing of it in so-called patriarchal culture.
The essays that I had to read in school and actually the movies that we studied that kind of tied into your writing, I believe that we saw Blackmail and read about that,
mm-hmm.
and then Rear Window and Vertigo. And Vertigo, I guess you could do a whole semester just talking about Vertigo.
Oh, God, yes. I had men writing to me and saying, you know, I've seen this film 69 times, and it was like, I don't know why I picked that number. I've seen this film 75 times, and it's like creepy, you know, because it's like, you know, Jimmy Stewart has this creepy stalking relationship to Kim Novak, and then I found that like a lot of people had this creepy stalking relationship to the film, you know, where they just couldn't, like, you know, stop gazing at it.
Well, I have to say that you really opened my eyes to a lot of things, and this was a time in my life when I never really looked past the surface of a film. So even to see some of these echoes, you know, like Barbara Bel Geddes talking about the bridge design and then how big the bridge looms, you know, and how big Kim Novak's breasts loom when Scotty's saving her from jumping in by the Golden Gate Bridge.
I enjoy that myself, but yeah.
It just really helped me to start to uncover more things in more movies, so I really appreciate that.
I'm always pleased to hear that.
The way that you were writing when it came to the Hitchcock book and then some of the other essays that I've read from the time, it seemed like there was a lot of responding going on. People were always kind of quoting from other people's articles and kind of taking other folks' things and kind of giving them a new spin. I mean, there are a lot of quotes from other authors in your work where you're speaking to other people. I mean, not just Freud, but also, and not just Mulvey, but other artists as it's going along. What is it like on the other side of that? What is it like when people quote from you and kind of respond to Tanya Modlesky's, you know, interpretation of this?
Well, if they say good things, I'm happy, and if they say bad things, I'm mad. I told my editor once, I'm one of those people who can dish it out, but I can't take it. And he was amused by that. But, you know, we're all very sensitive to criticism, and yet at the same time, you know, I do feel like I feel like I was born in the wrong era sometimes, and that, you know, the 18th century age of satire is more my thing. Because I love to find, like, quotes that I find outrageous and then make fun of them. So I did some of that with the whole male tradition of Hitchcock criticism in Blackmail. You know, there's a clear rape going on, and I just loved finding these quotes where the male critics were trying in every way possible not to call it a rape, and the sort of torturous language that they used to describe what happened was very revealing to me. That was another reason why it was a good place to start my work, I thought.
I've seen some of your other essays and just wonderful stuff as well, especially your take on Swept Away. I really like that. What are some of the things that you've been writing about lately? I saw that you did a piece on male weepies, and is that leading to something bigger?
I'd like to do a book on male weepies, called Male Weepies. The idea being that melodrama and the women's film and sentiment, melodrama and the women's film have been coterminous, and sentimental stories have always been seen as sort of feminine stories. But in one of my recent articles, I talk about Clint Eastwood's films and how much sentimentalism there is in those stories, and you know the tough guy business. You know, that's been sort of gratifying to sort of just say, look, you know, it's not just women crying over themselves. It's like men, if not crying over themselves, inviting it, the whole world to cry, you know, to cry for them. So I looked at several of his films in which he was director and the lead actor, and there were supposed writings of his earlier rewritings of his earlier tough guy image, Gran Torino revising Dirty Harry and Unforgiven as a Western, revising some of the early Western things that he did. And then I also talked about Million Dollar Baby, and just discuss it in terms of the way in which men's sorrows always seem to be elevated over women's, and the term that's often invoked is melancholia, which sounds sort of grandiose, you know, as opposed to women who are just depressed when they're sad. So that's what I was doing with that, and then I've actually been trying to work on bromances, by which I mean at this point at least the kind of Judd Apatow films, and talking about them in terms of melancholia. And it's a little bit it's a little hard to describe briefly how I relate melancholia to comedy, but I think it works. So I've been working on that for a long time. Bromances. Superbad, I think, is a subversive little film, and I really, you know, I think it's cool in a lot of ways. But some of the other Jonah Hill, maybe not so much.
When it came to the Clint Eastwood one, did you write about Bridges of Madison County?
I didn't, and I think, you know, and when I return to it and write it as a chapter of the book, I should do that, because it is interesting that he decided to do one that was more like a woman's film, you know, a romance.
Yeah, because there was some weird stuff going on in that film. I mean, I always picture him standing in the rain and just looking so haggard and old.
Yes,
and just,
everybody evokes that image. It's interesting. Yeah.
That, and then the brother and sister who seem like husband and wife that are kind of framing the story. That's just, when I watched that movie, I was really kind of creeped out by that.
I don't remember that. I haven't seen it since it came out, and I, you know, so I definitely have to go back and look at that, because I'm sure that's a crucial film for my purposes. Although I really wanted to do the ones that seemed not to be so, you know, melodramatic, like overtly, and to talk about how, you know, underneath there's this whole vein of sentimentalism. It's just bubbling under the surface. But I do think that it's important to maybe start out with Bridges of Madison County, because there is kind of frankly sentimental.
Going back to Hitchcock, we had talked a little bit about how you had chosen the films to write about. Did you kind of do the same thing where you avoided some of the more overt things? You know, I always think about like stage fright and the whole, you know, menstrual horror of stage fright. And I know you do write about that in the, at least in the...
In the afterword, yeah.
Were there some where you're just like, this is too obvious? Or
nothing is obvious in Hitchcock. I mean, some are bad. Like, I mean, Jamaica Inn is like execrable. It's just a horrible, horrible film. So, you know, there are a few that nobody writes about very much because they're just frankly bad. There aren't that many of them, but there are some. But others, I felt, I mean, I just had to limit myself because I really like to get in depth and not, you know, just cover a broad spectrum. So some that I would have liked to have written about and probably should have written about, like Marnie, I just didn't. Something like Shadow of a Doubt, I love. I mean, it's one of my favorite Hitchcock films, if not my favorite. But I had read some things about it that I thought were really, really good, and wasn't sure at the time that I would have all that much to add. You know, I probably, if I sat down, could have come up with something, but there were others that I thought were just going to be more available, you know, for me to say something that might be more original.
When you're writing about films, I mean, are you you know, taking copious notes as you're watching it and have to watch and rewatch something 1,000 times? Or how is it? What's your process like?
It depends. You know, as I saw Gran Torino once, and it was, you know, etched in my brain, and Million Dollar Baby too, you know, so sometimes I just, you know, come back and remember it, and then probably wind up reading something else and thinking, oh, damn, I didn't remember that scene. So it is always good to go back and watch it more than once. But sometimes, yeah, I watch it over and over again, like something like Vertigo. I spend a lot of time watching it and rewatching it. And I guess as far as the notes go, I mean, I was also teaching those films, so that's when I write a lot of notes when I'm watching the film. So then, you know, then they're available to me for when I want to write about them.
So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about Shadow of a Doubt, because, I mean, this film, there is so much going on, and there's some stuff that is pretty easy to pick up on the surface, but then there are other things where I'm still kind of scratching my head as I watch the film.
I'm scratching my head, too, you know, like the whole doubling of the uncle and the niece, you know. I don't know quite what to make of it. I mean, it's fascinating, you know, because part, of course, transference of guilt is that term that everybody has thrown out since the beginning of Hitchcock criticism, that the innocent person comes to be drawn into the guilt of the guilty person. And that certainly happens with the niece. But there is this all this incestuous stuff that's there, too, that's really interesting to me. But, you know, ultimately, I don't know how are we going to handle on it to write about it.
Well, I always like the mother's role in it and just how put down she is throughout the entire film. And she's kind of this figure that Charlie does not want to be. But she's so, I don't know if it's even sincerely empathetic to her, but she's constantly talking about how her mother is, you know, there's more to life than just working on the house, and that's all that mother ever does, and we really need to do something nice for her. But she doesn't have any clue as to what would be nice for her own mother.
You know, that part I can, like, totally identify with, because, you know, I certainly the last person I wanted to be was my mother, and yet at the same time I felt really close to her, and I felt that she works like a dog, as Charlie says, and, you know, never got any respite from working like a dog, and I just would, you know, wanted her to have more and better, and, you know, to be like appreciated more and things like that. And so, you know, I feel really very understanding of that, of what Charlie experiences in relation to her mother.
You know, I try to think of other protagonists inside of a Hitchcock film that are female and that are doing the investigation. And there are some that I can think of. You know, I can think of Marion Crane a little bit in Psycho, and obviously she gets killed off very early.
But then Lila, her sister, does the investigation and discovers the body, the skeleton in the basement.
And I think of, like, Patricia Hitchcock in Strangers on a Train, and all of the bespeckled women in Hitchcock films where they necessarily shouldn't be looking at things. But I don't know, I guess Charlie is punished for looking, but she does a pretty good job of uncovering the truth, even though she doesn't want to.
She does a good job. And you know what I love is that she's never, at least never for very long, made into a victim. There's that moment when I guess she's lying on the ground after having been nearly poisoned by carbon monoxide, being locked in the garage with a car running, and she's lying there and she looks like the ultimate female victim, and suddenly her eyes open wide and her uncle is looming over her, and she says, "Get out of town, Uncle Charlie, or I'll kill you myself." And it's like, whoa, you know? And it's just, you know, and she, like, I mean, after having been nearly killed, she becomes, you know, she transforms from victim into, you know, this person who seems almost as frightening as her uncle for a moment. And I love that.
Well, then it's strange, too, that she actually kind of almost becomes her uncle at one point by killing him.
Yeah, she kills him, and she wears the ring that he gives her off the dead body, and yeah, in some ways she's like the victims that he killed, and in some ways she's like him.
The scene that always gives me pause is when they go to the bar, and there's that really just downtrodden woman that's working at the bar, and that whole discussion of jewelry and everything, and it's just such a strange scene for me, but I love it nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, here's a small town, and it looks so clean and bright, but then he pulls her into this dive and this other world, you know, women from the other side of the tracks and soldiers and smoke and alcohol and stuff, and she's totally out of place and is being introduced to the dark side of everything and the, you know, alternatives to the kind of life that she might be living in the person of this girl who went to school with her.
Yeah, I guess so much of this film is her losing her innocence, maybe sexually, maybe not, but definitely just getting those, having the facade torn off the house, as Uncle Charlie would say.
I do want to say about the mother, there are those wonderful scenes, and I don't know if you knew, but the woman who plays the mother actually wrote that stirring speech that she gives at the end when she finds out that Charlie's going to be leaving the next day. And she talks about how you get, you know, what happens is you get married and you forget about the fact that you're you. And it's quite a feminist, you know, sort of statement, and seems rather astonishing coming from this woman who seems to have given up her life and given it over to the family.
Well, yeah, I mean, even more that it was 1943 that she's making that speech. I mean,
yeah, and that the actress actually was responsible for writing that speech, which I think is blown all of us away who've been looking for any kind of feminist message in Hitchcock. I mean, there it is writ large, you know. And she's a very interesting character because, I mean, she's comical, you know, survey or no survey, I can't go on making cakes. You know, she has funny lines. But she's also always almost on the verge of understanding that something's happening to her daughter, and nobody else is picking up on that at all. If you remember that scene where she says, funny, first the stairs, and now, and it never goes anywhere, but it's like she's almost a woman who knows, maybe not too much, but, you know, is starting to figure things out.
And even though her husband is obsessed with murder, his scenes with Hume Cronin are so good.
If Sally Benson wrote some of, you know, of course, Thornton Wilder did the script, but Sally Benson was called in to do some work on the script. And I think that she's probably, you know, responsible for some of the humor, because yeah, she wrote the book Meet Me in St. Louis, and she wrote a lot of stories like mid-century that were sort of mildly satirical of the family, of the American family. I think that film, some of its the strength of it as a woman's film is due to the fact that people like Sally Benson, and I'm forgetting the actress's name who plays the mother right now, but that, you know, that the two of them have some input in what the final script came.
To me, there's a Dracula thing going on throughout the film as well.
Yeah. Well, I think it was playing around, and I'm sure that much can be done with it. James McLaughlin wrote a piece in which he talks about the vampire aspect of it. I guess I would say it's kind of like about the sort of, just like vampirism is about drawing people into that netherworld of neither dead nor alive, that the vampirism is about drawing, you know, drawing the innocent into this nighttime world and drawing the viewer into this nighttime world. And I think that's part of, like, you know, when Charlie is lying on the ground unconscious and then suddenly opens her eyes, you know, it's like, you know, I can't help but think of Dracula in his coffin, you know, with his eyes like suddenly opening and, you know, sitting up, and like a horrifying moment in Dracula. And so she she becomes part of the guilty world of the vampire.
Yeah, I wonder if it's almost like she had died in the garage and she's coming back from the dead.
Something like that, yeah.
Just one more question about Shadow of a Doubt as far as what you're thinking about the younger sister character.
Love her. She's like the Patricia Hitchcock character in Stage Fright and Strangers on a Train. She says some of the things that nobody else wants to say because people are too polite. First of all, she another woman who knows too much. She understands immediately that there's something wrong with Uncle Charlie. Remember how she doesn't want to sit with him at dinner time. And she just does not cotton to Joseph Cotton at all. And she's very smart. She's one of those bespectacled women you were talking about, or bespectacled females who know too much. But in this case, she's not punished for it. I wanted to talk about the influence of female collaborators on Hitchcock's work. And, of course, his wife did so much. Everybody testifies to the fact that she was so important to the way the scripts finally came out. But, there's no way of telling. You go to the archives and, unfortunately, there's no little thing like, Alma Hitchcock wrote this part. Because that's not even the way collaboration works. You sit together and you talk and you brainstorm and you get ideas and nothing gets written down. And, I found some stuff that was interesting. And I, managed to get an article out of it and, felt kind of good about what I came up with. But, the flip side of Hitchcock's being maybe playing bad practical jokes on some of his actresses and punishing them and stuff is that he surrounded himself with women. Joan Harrison was a scriptwriter and producer and had all kinds of jobs working with Hitchcock on many of his important films. And but I'm not the only one who's tried to figure out exactly what Joan Harrison's role was in these films, and it's very, very hard to tell. There are no papers in any collections that I've found that give you much indication. So a lot of what you know somebody worked on something and you could kind of speculate on what their influence might have been, but it is speculation in the end.
Well, even Edith Head in some of the outfits, especially in Vertigo.
Totally. And Rear Window, both of them. But you're right, even more so in Vertigo. I was just up north and came across a redwood tree, with exactly the, Magna Carta sign, da da da, things like that. So I had somebody snap a picture of me and I put it on Facebook with the quote, "Somewhere in here I was born and there I died. It was only a moment for you. You took no notice." So I was saying to the person who was snapping the picture, the only thing that's missing is that white coat, because she's wearing that white coat and looking like a ghost in the midst of the redwood forest, and the ghostly shadows and all of that. Edith Head, extremely important, and one of his illustrators, name I'm forgetting now, she died just recently at the age of 99, before I got to interview her. She did work on the visual aspects of some of the films. So there was, he had a lot of women doing a lot of things, and I think that perhaps accounts for some of the complex ways in which his women were developed, as opposed to the one-dimensional ways that often you get in Hollywood.
The third act of the Screen Director's Playhouse presentation of Shadow of a Doubt continues in just a minute.
Welcome back to the projection booth, and thanks again to Ms. Modaleski for the discussion. There'll be a linking over at our website, projection-booth.com, as to all the fun places that you can pick up her book, The Women Who Knew Too Much, So getting back to the discussion on Shadow of a Doubt, Mike, and all the various remakes and reincarnations and interpretations and all that fun stuff, where do you sort of see it beginning?
I kind of see a lot of the origins of Shadow of a Doubt in The Lodger, the silent film that Hitchcock had made. I guess I'm stuck in a college rut today. I'll tell you this story that I took a class on Hitchcock in college, and I don't know what it is about me, but when I find a class that I really love and I really appreciate it, I freaking tank at those classes every single time. I think I got a B in my horror and film class, and I got probably a B or maybe even a B minus in my Hitchcock and cinema class, and I loved it. And I don't know, I think something that had something to do with that was me thinking that I was breaking new ground by, I had to take a Blue Book exam, and suddenly I got the idea of, oh my God, you know what? Shadow of a Doubt really feels like a kind of a remake of some of the aspects of The Lodger, and I'm going to write this big essay about that during this test. So I wrote that, and as I'm doing my research now on Shadow of a Doubt, I find that that is definitely not a very original idea at all.
Well, you just had what they would call the singularity or serendipity or whatever, where a bunch of people start thinking the same way at the same time.
That must be it. And that must be why my prof said, this guy has no original thoughts.
Why was it with The Lodger for you?
The story of The Lodger, very briefly, is that there is a murderer loose in London. You know, it's the story of the London Fog is the subtitle for The Lodger. There's a murderer loose in London who is fixated on women with golden curls. And there is a man who moves into a house. He is the lodger. And people start to think that this stranger is the murderer, and there's a lot of people trying to figure out who he is, what's going on, and there's this kind of mob mentality that comes about. And really, I guess you could almost say that had Uncle Charlie been the guy that they pursued and not had been guilty, that he would be very similar to the lodger. You know, he comes in, takes this upstairs room, and, you know, if people, people were suspecting him, Charlie was starting to suspect that Uncle Charlie was this murderer, and, you know, finding all of this evidence. And, you know, at one point, Uncle Charlie even says, you know, what evidence do you have against me? You know, a song comes into your head and there are initials on a ring, you know, basically you have nothing. And the same could be said for the lodger character. Is there's a lot of circumstantial evidence pointing at this guy, nothing concrete. In that one, he ends up being innocent, but he could very much easily have been the guy who gets pursued and killed in Shadow of a Doubt. We always tend to forget that while they're pursuing Uncle Charlie on the West Coast, there's another man on the East Coast who ends up running into a prop propeller of a plane and dying. He was perfectly innocent.
Beyond the lodger, when we talk about the script and sort of how it's evolved into Shadow of a Doubt, what sort of, where does it come from and what do you see are the differences? Because I know you spend a lot of time reading all this stuff.
There's a great book by Dan, I'm not even going to pronounce the last name, A-U-I-L-E-R, called Hitchcock's Notebooks. And I want to say that there might be two volumes of this thing. And they actually have, if not the whole thing, at least part of the original short story that Shadow of a Doubt was based on. And that was just called Uncle Charlie. And then it went from that to Thornton Wilder, who we all know wrote Our Town, as well as just a ton of other stuff that nobody ever talks about. The Skin of Our Teeth is one of those. And he wrote the script for Shadow of a Doubt by hand, and they have reproductions of his longhand version of Shadow of a Doubt in this book, and it is terrific. I mean, it's only a few scenes, so it's not the whole darn thing. I would love to read the whole darn thing one of these days, because what I have read is one of the later drafts after Wilder had left the project. He went into World War II. I'm not sure if he got drafted or if he volunteered, but he left, and then the script went into the hands of women, actually. It was Sally Benson, I believe her name is, who had written a ton of stuff, screenplays as well as books. And then Hitchcock's longtime contributor, his wife. And then I hear that even some, we've heard in the interview with Miss Modleski that the mom from the movie had some input on the script as well. So it was interesting to read this version of the script and see how far they were. Some of the revisions were as late as August of 1942. And some of the things that were in there that ended up being changed for the final film were kind of telling as well. There is a little bit more as far as the two cops who come to Santa Rosa, just a little bit more exchanges between those two. Not a ton, but we're still not getting the relationship between the cop and young Charlie that we might. But some of the other telling things, some of the things that we've even mentioned before were slightly different. Rather than the Till 2 bar, it was called the Have One bar. Rather than tell me the story of Dracula to young Anne, the cop asked, tell me the story of Jekyll and Hyde. So again, we have the duality going on there, and you know, really points to this, the evil face that we don't show to people. But and then a ton more of Roger's OCD, which is just him counting everything and, you know, always doing arithmetic in his head and stuff. So, but yeah, it's interesting to see what those changes were. And the screenplay was like 200 and some pages, which is odd. And I don't think that the movie would have been over 200 minutes long, but I'm not really seeing a whole lot of stuff that they ended up dropping. There weren't huge swaths of screenplay that ended up on the cutting room floor. But just to think that even what Wilder wrote, what I read as far as his handwritten stuff, it was wonderful. It was so rich and so full of details, and the dialogue is just crisp. And, you know, you've got those great speeches. I mean, we talked about the, you know, the swine speech, and then there's the speech of the widows, Uncle Charlie talking about the widows. And in a little bit, I'll play back all of the kind of interpretations of that speech that we've heard through here. Because One Shadow of a Doubt went from script to screen. We've got several interpretations of it that came out afterwards. And I felt kind of bad, you know, because I kept throwing stuff over to you like, here, watch this one. Here, watch this one. Here, watch that one. So I feel bad when it's like, yeah, we're going to review one movie, but there are, you know, six things that you need to watch in order to review the one film.
Yeah, and I appreciate that.
No problem. So what'd you think of Step Down to Terror, the 1958 interpretation of
Step Down to Terror? Let me just do a broad overview of the two that I watched. Yeah, I did not watch the 1991 made-for-TV remake. You told me it was awful and I shouldn't watch it, so I didn't. I did watch Step Down to Terror, and I did watch Return of Dracula. Now, the problem that I have with both of them is that they're too far away from the immediate family in terms of their characters to actually work. Like, the reason why, for me, the Hitchcock film works is because you have the character that has the duality, you have the names, you have the closeness, you have all these things. And Step Down to Terror, at least, it's a closer relative. It's like a brother-sister relationship. But still, there's not that buy-in that you get in the same way in the Hitchcock film. And definitely with The Return of Dracula, where it's some sort of like cousin they haven't seen in decades from Eastern Europe, that by the time things get wacky, it's like, well, they don't really have a buy-in to this person on an emotional level, so why not just turn them over to the cops? Why not just, you know, I mean, the whole reason why the Hitchcock film works is because these people would be conflicted with this character. They would be conflicted because they care about the person so much. In Step Down to Terror and Return of Dracula, there's such a division. There's such sort of a familial division that it's like, what do I care if, you know, cousin so-and-so from Eastern Europe is the murderer? I'm just going to turn him over. So I thought that was the big thing. The one thing that I thought was interesting is you have, especially with Step Down to Terror, with the ending, it's the same thing again, where it's about the veneer of suburban small town America and all that stuff and keeping up appearances. And even in death, we can't tell the truth because once again, we have the funeral thing again and they're lying about him. So it's just, you know, it's the same thing again. And then the other thing that's funny is the use of the same dialogue over and over again in terms of those speeches. And I know they're marquee speeches because obviously Joseph Cotten just nails it. Like, it's so good in Shadow of a Doubt that they're like, you know what, we're going to need that. We're going to, you know, like rip everything and put, keep that and just change a few things. I guess maybe it's kind of like reading someone's term paper that was, you know, researched on Wikipedia or something, or someone's term paper that they bought from someone else and then they just change a few things. It's like, hey, I remember reading this somewhere. Oh, yeah. I liked it the first time when it was called Shadow of a Doubt.
I think they were trying to set up more of a potential love triangle when it came to Step Down to Terror, because we still have the mother character. The father character is suspiciously absent. The Uncle Charlie character is the mother's son, and there were two sons. So it's not her brother anymore. It's now one of her sons. And the woman, who would be the young Charlie character, was married to the son who died. So we have a missing father, a missing son, the crazy son, and then the wife who still lives with her mom. So it is strange. And then they've also got that whole thing where they really play up, because you get it a little bit in Shadow of a Doubt as far as what made Uncle Charlie go wrong.
46 Burnham Street.
Mm-hmm. It was taken the Christmas you got your bicycle, just before your accident.
Uncle Charlie, you were beautiful.
Wasn't he, though? And such a quiet boy, always reading. I always said Papa never should have bought you that bicycle. You didn't know how to handle it, Charlie. He took it right out on the icy road and skidded into a streetcar. He thought he was going to die.
I'm glad he didn't.
Well, he almost did. He fractured his skull. And he was laid up so long. And then, when he was getting well, there was no holding him. And it was just as though all the rest he had was, well, too much for him, and he had to get into mischief to blow up steam. He didn't do much reading after that, let me tell you. It was taken the very day he had his accident. And then a few days later, when the pictures came home, our mama cried. She wondered if he'd ever look the same. She wondered if he'd ever be the same.
What's the use of looking backward? What's the use of looking ahead? Today's the thing. That's my philosophy. Today.
But they really play that thing up in Step Down to Terror to the point where Johnny Williams Walters, I like how he's got kind of a serial killer name, the guy that Charles Drake plays, he's actively destroying bicycles because he got into his accident when he was a kid. And even seeing a bicycle on the street like totally freaks him out.
But that whole thing too, with the idea that, okay, they're off now because something bad happened to them, which is sort of an excuse against, like we were saying, the small town suburbia that the kids were raised in, supposedly. So it's like saying, we could never build a monster here. The kid would have been fine if he would have grown up here with us. But he had something happen to him, and therefore that's why he goes bad. So it's like, we're not going to take responsibility for the monster. And number two, we're going to lie about the monster even being in our presence once he's dead. Those two things really bother me. Either it's seen as commentary, and I'm trying to figure out if they're trying to make comment on keeping up appearances, or if it's just denial of acceptance of bad things within the midst.
He's kind of a stranger coming to town, the Uncle Charlie character, and even though he's kind of returning to this small town that he came from, I mean, they really play that up when it comes to Return of Dracula, where it's this foreigner, this Eastern European person, which already puts a cast onto who this person is. And you made a point earlier as far as, had they made Shadow of a Doubt 10 years later, you would have had this kind of Red Scare thing going on. And you could almost interpret Return of Dracula kind of that same way, where you have this heavily accented Eastern European coming in and being this evil force in this little town. I think that would be a nice way to read this film as well, and not just as a reinterpretation of Shadow of a Doubt.
It's definitely on that level. I would say that it could be seen as, you know, okay, maybe he's Russian or something. You know, he's obviously not Russian because he doesn't have a Russian accent, but it could be considered as an anti-communist thing, or even just a mark on xenophobic fear of the 50s, where just the other. You know, I mean, America at this time is still WASPy, so anyone who's not from England, you know, and Western Europe is kind of looked down upon. So he could be a stand-in for any, you know, maybe Catholic or Eastern European other.
Right. The other thing that is interesting, too, is that he's an artist. And you also have that whole prejudice. This is 1958, same year that Step Down to Terror was made, and which is kind of weird, too, that both of these things are happening and both of them seem to be playing off of this Hitchcock film. But, you know, it's late 1950s, and not only do you have a suspicion of the outsider, but then that he's an artist on top of it, or at least the person that he killed, Belloc Gordal, he was an artist, and then also the young girl in this film is an artist as well. And so you've kind of got that, don't go towards that. That's kind of bad. You need to, you know, really get more in line with what's happening in your community. You know, you can't be an artist. You need to have a real profession. At least that's how I interpreted some of this.
Well, take it also that around this time, 58 or so, what would be in the headlines that was starting to get attention would be things like Allen Ginsberg and his obscenity trial over Howell. It would be things like 10 years previous and into the early 50s, Jackson Pollock. Jackson Pollock, I think, may have even been, you know, if not dead, on his way out around that time. And just the idea that, you know, the idea of artists as a career or as a life choice in some way are dangerous individuals. They're going to lead you down this terrible path. And they're definitely going to lead you away from the suburban idealism. They're going to lead you into dirty cities and urban environments with people who may not necessarily be, you know, living the husband-wife, 2.1 kids, nuclear family existence. So I can definitely see that. And the fact in this one that's really interesting that I find interesting about Return of Dracula is sort of twofold. One is there's a lot of close-ups in this film. It's like there's a lot of faces. It's a lot of like people looking at, you know, looking around. I mean, this whole film was like 150 close-ups and like three establishing shots. It's pretty amazing in that way. And then the other thing that's interesting is instead of the girl in the family coming under his spell, it's like a friend of the girl.
Yeah, a blind girl, nonetheless.
There's this whole thing with her becoming sort of a minion of him and, you know, in this sort of Van Helsing character. But the thing that's really interesting about it is for a film that's called The Return of Dracula, the name Dracula I don't think has ever brought up the whole thing.
No, which is weird. And then, speaking of the Van Helsing character, I love that when he comes into town, it takes so little to convince the other people in town, especially the priest that's there, that they have this evil that they need to fight. There's not like, you know, no, I tell you, it's a vampire. We have to fight him. It's just like, here I am. Here's this guy. We should go after him. Okay, cool. You know, where's the steak? Let's go.
It's just such a given. It's like, oh, yeah, we knew that you were coming. We got a telegraph that you would be here. And much like you were talking about with Shadow of a Doubt, where he comes off the train and he's all like, hey, you know, how you doing? There's this whole thing. It's supposed to be mysterious, but they're like looking around for him. Like, hey, I guess he was around here somewhere. And then he just sort of magically appears behind them. Oh, he's a jokester.
That's one of the points where you really see the similarity between the two films. I mean, you could, if you really got into your head, you could argue and say, no, there's no similarity between Return of Dracula and Shadow of a Doubt. But I think you would really have to argue that pretty hard. I think this is probably one of the biggest remakes without giving credit to any of the original players that I've seen for a long time. But it's to me, there's no doubt that these two films are kind of married.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that you don't have in Return of Dracula, and it's just by virtue of the fact that the lead character is from another country and has an accent and all this stuff, is that you don't get all the misanthropic monologues. You don't get all of him saying, oh, they're all swine and, you know, these stupid women who are widows and they deserve what they get. There's none of that. And I don't even think that that's needed because there's really no sort of merry widow killer thing. It's just sort of he's decided to come over to hang out, I guess, and, you know, set up a franchise in beautiful sunny California or wherever the hell he's gone.
Yeah, it's funny how the city names are just so prominent in these films too. I mean, you know, Santa Rosa, we all know where that is, and or as far as, you know, everyone says Santa Rosa, and sending a telegraph to Santa Rosa. And then when it comes to the other films, you know, it's just like, you know, there's on-screen title cards for where we're at, and they're not Santa Rosa, but they're pretty darn close.
Mellonville.
You know, you had talked about the patented speeches that we have in Shadow of a Doubt, and those definitely come up again when I listen to the radio interpretations of that. That was one thing that I didn't give you for homework, as it were, was some of the radio adaptations of this. Some of them are, there's one that's an hour. Actually, I think two of them are an hour, and then you've got two that have actually been condensed down to a half an hour. And it's funny to listen to those and, again, see which players are there and which aren't. Of course, Herbie, the next door neighbor, is not there, which I love. I love that Herbie and the father are so into solving mysteries, but yet they don't even see that they have a killer that's living with them. Anyway, every single one of those really hits those points that we were talking about as far as those speeches, the swine speech and the widow speech that we have. And it was great hearing these different interpretations of not just the speeches, but also of the story itself. I mean, and they were powerhouse players that were doing this. I mean, we had Uncle Charlie was played by William Powell, the thin man himself. We had Cary Grant, who would go on to work with Hitchcock a ton. And then we had Joseph Cotten reprising his role twice with different radio interpretations of those. So like I said earlier, gosh, and I'm, you know what we're doing? We're totally flipping by the 1991 remake, which I told you was bad, and it is bad. And it is really, it's awful. And it's, but I'll play this montage that I put together of the widow's speech is what I call it. And then I will play a little bit of Mark Harmon doing the swine speech. So you can just hear how off, I don't want to say his performance is off, but definitely the writing is lacking in this one. And they really kind of missed the mark on a lot of this stuff. So we'll go ahead and we'll play those back and be right back.
Yes, most women keep busy in towns like this. Cities is different.
Cities are another matter. Cities are filled with women.
Cities are full of women, middle-aged widows, husbands dead.
The husbands who spent their lives making thousands, working, working, working. And then they die, leave the money to their wives.
They're silly wives. And what do these women do? These useless women.
You see them in the hotels, the best hotels, every day by the thousands.
Breaking their money, eating their money, losing their money at bridge, playing all day and night, smelling of money and proud of it.
Horrible.
Fat, faded, greedy women. Useless, pointless. They shouldn't even be allowed to exist. They give nothing and they take everything.
Stupid women, smelling of money they never earned, dripping with diamonds they traded their souls for. Yes, and worked their husbands to death for. Why, they're not even animals. They're parasites. They're not even worth the air they breathe.
Proud of their jewelry, but of nothing else. Horrible. Faded, greedy women.
But they're alive. They're human beings.
Are they?
Are they human? Or are they just
fat, wheezing animals?
Animals.
Huh? What happens to animals
when they get too fat and too old?
Well, for heaven's sake, Charles.
You live in a dream, Charlie. Blind, a sleepwalker, knowing nothing of the world. Have you any idea just how foul it is out there? Do you know that when you rip the face off of houses, you'll find nothing there except stinking corruption? That it's a pigsty? That the world is a pigsty? Now surely those who helped defile it should depart this world without regret? I mean, what possible difference could it make, Charlie? Use your wits. Learn something, Charlie. Learn, dear Charlie. If you don't, then in this life, you're certain to suffer the consequences.
All right, we're back. So yeah, poor Mark Harmon kind of stuck in this. And then, I mean, even really the rest of the cast, you got Diane Ladd as the mother character. And, you know, the girl that played young Charlie wasn't too bad. Young Charlie in this one was not that young. And I think that was the thing that we saw in some of the other interpretations of Shadow of a Doubt. I mean, especially in Return of Dracula, I think she's supposed to be kind of teenager going into 20s, but she looks rough, man. She is not looking that young. And then, of course, we've got in Step Down to Terror, she's already had a kid, and, you know, it's not the younger brother, it's her son is who we're talking about. So it's she's fair to be a little bit older in that one. But I think having Charlie be young Charlie, and kind of this is kind of her awakening into the world, I think is definitely very valuable as part of the whole narrative overall.
I agree with that. I think that what's interesting, and as obviously I didn't watch the 1991 remake, but I think what's interesting is you have three different movies all sort of on the same, either the same script or riffing off of the same ideas. For you, do you see them all as worth the time to watch, or do you really have to love Shadow of a Doubt and then you watch it just to go, oh, that was in there, and oh, that was in there?
I definitely wouldn't track down the 91 remake. I would just kind of write that one out of history. I don't think I would take the time to track down Step Down to Terror again anytime soon. But Return of Dracula, I actually found it to be a fairly interesting film. And it's, I think right now it's streaming on Netflix. So if people have that, go for it. And it's not that hard to find. I think it was released as one of those MGM midnight movie double features a few years ago. So it's available for rental. I don't think I would spend the money to buy it, but it's worth a look. It's shot pretty darn well. I think it looks really nice. And for me, it is a nice interpretation of this other film, and it kind of stands on its own two legs. I don't know what you think about that.
I agree with you. I think Step Down to Terror is like a watered-down version of Shadow of a Doubt. There really isn't a lot of changes that make it interesting or sort of worth the time. But I think Return of Dracula is interesting because it is low budget, and the fact that it's taking what we like from Shadow of a Doubt and then putting this extra spin on it. And I also, as I was saying, I like the fact that it's basically 150 close-ups and three establishing shots.
Right.
That's really interesting. So I just like the idea that, you know, whoever made this is like, we need you to look in, you know, over there, and then look over there, and then look over there, and then we can save money on set dressing.
It's funny, they even start with a close-up of the face, you know, the whole face is in darkness, and then you see the eyes when the Return of Dracula thing comes up. So yeah, they're playing with that all through there. I like that Francis Lederer as Count Dracula is very low-key in the film. It really takes a lot to get him, his dander up. But I would say the opposite is true for Charles Drake in Step Down to Terror, where he just seems mad or anxious all the time. And I like that Joseph Cotten kind of plays it right down the middle, where you don't necessarily know what's going on or what's going to happen. Like, even when he grabs Charlie's arm and she's, you know, saying, ow, you're hurting my arm, he's just, you know, very calm, very collected. You know, it takes a lot to break through that facade.
He's just a stone-cold sociopath.
He is. He is. And you're right. We had talked a little bit before that other circumstances, you might be rooting for him. And sometimes, maybe you still are, even when it comes to knowing what he is. You kind of want to see this guy, and you want to know what makes him tick.
Exactly. And that's the thing that I think really makes Shadow of a Doubt an interesting film, considering the era in which it came out. As I said, this is 43, so this is the middle of the war. And to have something that's just sort of dark in a way and kind of questioning a lot of the assumptions of small town America or suburban America at the time, I think is kind of revolutionary in a way. Okay, we're going to take another break and play a preview from next week's show.
Look, I am the director. I've been directing 10-cent movies for 30 years, and I think I know a little bit about what I'm doing. It's a horrible world. There's starvation, dismemberment, torture, rape, cornholing. It's horrible out there. But it's worse. It's worse here in the movie set. It's much worse. We have danger and stupidity. I don't want somebody dying on my set. If someone dies here, I'll blow my brains out. It'll be your fault. My career will be over. It'll be your fault. Wow. Now where are them big-titted women at?
Oh, God.
Terror firmer.
What we got here is your basic serial killer.
You know, your killer's choices of victims indicate some sort of personal animosity against you and your company.
Family values must be saved.
Yeah, right.
Where's the blood? Where's the blood? Where's the blood?
No. Run for your lives. There's a killer on the movie set.
Oh, my God. We're done. We're done. No. This is a trauma movie.
That guy is really dead.
What's that?
These movie people are disgusting.
Terror Burmer.
Don't give up the fight for a truly independent cinema.
Inspired by Lloyd Kaufman's book, All I Need to Know About Filmmaking, I Learned from the Toxic Avenger. Available at fine bookstores everywhere. From Troma, of course.
That's right, we're going from the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock, to the master of schlock, Lloyd Kaufman. We'll be talking about his 1999 film Terror Firmer, and we'll be joined again by Mr. Kaufman, as well as Terror Firmer's star, Will Keenan.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of The Projection Booth. Of course, make sure to stop by the website and give us your thoughts on this episode or any, you know, recipes you might have, a good casserole, or maybe you have another waltz you would like to play for us. I don't know. Maybe you've figured something out about Shadow of a Doubt that we didn't figure out in our massive interpretations, feminist film history, socialist film history. I don't know. You figure it out. The place to go is projection-booth.com. Of course, if you download us from iTunes or Stitcher or some other one of those sundry items out there on the internet in terms of various apps and fun things, make sure you leave us stars and reviews, a thumbs up, and also tell your friends, you know, because people like movies, and that's why people listen to The Projection Booth.
Find out if you were alone, walk in, hit you on the head with a piece of lead pipe or a loaded cane.
What'd be the fun of that? Where's your planning? Where's your clues?
I don't want any clues. I want to murder you. What do I want with clues?
Well, if you haven't got any clues, where's your book?
I'm not talking about writing books. I'm talking about killing you.
Well, if I was going to kill you, I wouldn't do a dumb thing like hitting you on the head. First of all, I don't like the fingerprint angle. Of course, I could always wear gloves, press your hands against the pipe after you were dead, and make you look like a suicide. Except it don't seem hardly likely that you'd beat yourself to death with a club. I'd murder you so it didn't look like murder.